This is the La Carre Cast. Hello and welcome to La Carre Cast. My name is Jeff and I'm your host. I write about spies at my site spywrite.com, and over the years I've written quite a bit about the works of John Le Carre. In each episode, we like to take a deeper dive into all things Le Carre, and I'm pleased to welcome back as my guest, Matthew Bradford. Matthew previously spoke with me about A Murder of Quality and his essay collection looking at the George Smiley novels at his website, 00section.blogspot.com, is well worth your time to explore. Matthew's passion for espionage fiction is legendary, and his encyclopedic knowledge of spies is also well known among all of us spy fans, so I'm excited to welcome him back to the show. This time, we're going to do something a little bit different. Over the next 4 weeks, I'll have a weekly episode released. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of John Le Carre's recently released posthumous novel, Silverview. This week, we'll be focusing on the main characters. First, though, I have to ask Matthew, how surprised were you when this book was announced?
I don't know that I was delighted. I don't know if I was surprised because there had been hints that he had left something behind at the time that he passed away. You know, there were some things from Johnny Geller, his agent and our manager, publisher. So I'm not, I forget what his title is, but
literary agent, I think is what they call him.
Yeah. And I think some other, I believe William Boyd had dropped, I'm not sure how he had that information, but I think in a piece that he wrote, he had said something about rumors that he had left something behind. So we'd known that there was a chance, but I was certainly hoping that we were going to get another. So it wasn't total surprise, but it was very much, you know, fulfilling my wishes. I was very, very glad to hear that there was one last finished work coming from my favorite author after he had passed away.
Yeah. For me, I was surprised in two ways. You know, yes, I assumed there'd be something else out there, but the fact that we had number one so quickly, something coming out, because he passed away in December and here we are in November getting this release. I was surprised because I figured it would be some sort of longer kind of gestation period for that. And then the other thing was that this was a completed novel, because I think there had been the rumors that you were referencing were of something else that he'd been working on when he passed away.
That's true.
And this is actually something that he had written, kind of threw in the drawer and just left sit there, but had given his blessing to be released after his death.
Yeah, I was surprised by what it was. There were also rumors of a completed novel, but this wasn't what I was expecting. I was thinking of Adam Seisman had referenced a Joseph Conrad inspired piece that he left behind, and maybe this is it. I haven't read enough Conrad that I could necessarily detect the themes, but it's not referencing, at least not to me, very obviously referencing the two Conrad spy novels that I have read that I kind of thought it would be, or you know, his most famous works. So I don't know. Did you detect any Conrad influence in this?
I'm not well versed in Conrad as other people, so I couldn't necessarily say that I did. No.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the famous, the secret agent, where there is this kind of bookseller. I guess that's the loosest kind of way you could connect it, right?
Yeah, I thought that, well, when I read the description, I thought maybe it's going to be that, but the way that the story plays out is not reminiscent of the secret agent, really.
Yeah.
I didn't think. I guess maybe there are some slight, but not in a way. I was expecting something as much of an homage as The Tailor of Panama is to Graham Greene, to that, or Under Western Eyes, the other big spy novel that Conrad did. And it's not obvious to me if you know, it's definitely not like Tower of Panama. It's not a hit you over the head kind of almost remake, the way that was of Our Man in Havana. So maybe this is that, but I'm thinking it's not. This to me felt like a different novel than what I said. So there may be one. It was unclear how complete that one was, you know, so that might be one of the unfinished that you know, never sees the light of day. There may be some other unfinished things. So yeah, I guess that was a surprise that there was a completed novel and that it came so quickly, which I think attests to the fact that it's true, because you're never sure what to believe. And they've been pretty transparent with us. There's an afterword in the American edition and in the Waterstones exclusive of the English edition by Nick Harkaway, Le Carre's son, who did the polish on this, which, you know, he's open about. And I get the feeling he's being honest with us in the amount of work he says he put into this. And I think that the speed with which it came out sort of backs that up, because if he had actually finished the book or done a major new draft of it, I don't think we would have had something within a year of Le Carre's death. Do you?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And it also, it doesn't read like something that has been kind of Frankenstein together.
No, it doesn't.
For lack of a better term.
So. Yeah.
Let's dive into some of these characters, because I do feel, you know, this is a speedy read.
Yeah.
Even with that, it is kind of a character focused piece of work, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost a novella more than a novel. It's definitely his thinnest book, I think, since probably his first two. I haven't done a page count, but I would think so. And it's also not only thin, but it's much larger type than most of them. So if it were in the font and size of some of the other recent ones, I think it would be even thinner. And it's a very fast read. I would say that it's very character focused. I don't think that's atypical of him. It's interesting, though, you had a guest a few weeks ago, B, who was talking about how his novels, he's tended toward focusing on the main character more. And I hadn't thought of that. That was an interesting point that she brought up. And I think there are definite exceptions to that, but I'd say that she's right, that that's the overall trajectory of his work. And this is not a single character piece at all. This is very much an ensemble. You know, we go between multiple characters throughout the book. I'm actually not even sure who I would say is the lead. Like, Julian is the ostensible, like, lead, our eyes into the happenings that are going on. He's the average guy sort of here, a bookseller who's left. He's left a successful career in investment to become a bookseller and is making a kind of rough go of it at the time that we meet him. And he's the person who's going to meet the spies, you know, and be used by them, be a doorway in. But I'm not sure I would call him the lead character of this book. There's also, I mean, there's at least two other contenders, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I would say this book reminds me a lot of other Le Carre books. I mean, not surprisingly,
yeah,
but in one way, yeah. And one way in particular, I see kind of a small town in Germany, mm-hmm. where you have Leo, who is this kind of elusive figure that we hear through other people. Right. And even though we meet our other character, Teddy, Edward Avon, right?
Yes.
Edvard, as he is occasionally referred to as well. He is the real spy in this book. And he's also, though, the person that we learn about mainly through other people's reactions to him and discussions about him, even though we do see him talk to our other characters, right?
Yes. Yeah, which is different from small town in Germany, or Drake Coe's brother in Honorable Schoolboy, I was reminded of too, who we're learning about through a series of interviews, the way that we learn a lot about Edvard here. But yeah, unlike those characters, he is a presence throughout the book, an enigmatic presence, but a presence. In fact, he wanders into Julian's bookstore and introduces himself to him and reveals a surprise connection to Julian's own father, which, you know, gives him a direct connection to Julian. So that's more than those other characters had, you know, that you just referenced. But yes, we don't learn firsthand. We don't follow Edward Avon and, you know, learn what he's doing through him. We learn about what he's doing and what he's done in the past through other people. Yes. But still, I'd say he is the overarching presence of this book. Like, I think it's about him more than any other character. And I think that his motivations are the most thematically consistent with previous Le Carre lead characters. Like, ever since The Honorable Schoolboy, I feel like Le Carre has again and again done versions of Jerry Westerby, of a character who works for the intelligence services, but is drawn by higher ideals, whether there is love, well, always by love, but whether it's love for a person, love for a country, love for a people, various higher ideals to break with the service. And there's so many variations on that character, I think, in his work ever since then, not in every book, but in most books. So I feel like, in terms of who we're used to being the lead character in a Le Carre novel, Edward is the closest, even though he is enigmatic and we learn most about him through other people, but he fits that mold that we've come to. And then there's also a spy hunter who is sort of in the Smiley mold, sort of in the Jack Brotherhood mold from A Perfect Spy, although a much more likable character than Jack Brotherhood. And that's Proctor.
Right, Stuart Proctor, which I got to say, a great name. Although, as I was looking it up, I was like, oh, now maybe it's a little bit too on the nose, because I was looking at definitions of Proctor. And in the North American term, it's a person who monitors students during an examination. But in apparently the British framing, it's an officer at universities appointed and having mainly disciplinary functions. So very much what this character is doing, right?
Absolutely. Although on the nose, I mean, I just compared him to a character named Jack Brotherhood. So on the nose is not new for Le Carre in character naming.
No, no, it's not. But it is still, it is a great name. And I do love that.
Yeah.
And he has various other pseudonyms throughout, right? Where he's taking on other identities throughout the book as he's kind of doing his various interrogations. Because really, almost every time we see him is some sort of form of an interrogation.
Yes. It's, again, reminded me of the Honorable Schoolboy format, where in that it's, you know, Connie Sachs and, now I'm forgetting that great character's name who's always fidgeting, the head of the China section. I don't remember, but they go around interviewing people about the Coes and stuff. And then Westerby, of course, doing interviews in the field in China, leading to, you know more about these characters. And this is that format again, that formula. Also reminded me of Small Town in Germany, like you pointed out, which also is, you know, interviewing people to learn about someone we're not meeting. But most directly, it reminded me of The Honorable Schoolboy, because we get so many great, memorable places and people that we meet along the way through this format, the same as in that book, where you'll have characters who you only spend one chapter with, but leave an indelible imprint. And that definitely happens here in the course of Proctor's interviews. So we do get to know Proctor himself. We get to know him more than we ever get to know Edward Avon through his own actions. But yeah, I think we even more get to know some of these other characters through his interrogations.
Well, what I found interesting when I, you know, thinking about when Le Carre wrote this book was right after A Delicate Truth. And I felt that made a lot of sense, right? Because you have Julian, who's this younger character kind of drawn into this stuff. And then you have Proctor. And I do think that if you're going to look at the two, where the story bounces between is the two of them, right? We meet other characters, but it's through each of their lenses. Right. I don't know that we see a different framing that doesn't involve either one of those two.
That's true.
And we did see something similar in A Delicate Truth, right? Where you have this, you know, it was very trumpeted at the time, right? One of the characters in A Delicate Truth is old Le Carre, and one of the characters is young Le Carre. And so you see that. And I felt like this is very much still kind of spinning out of that kind of concept a little bit.
Yeah. And I got the feeling that Le Carre himself was sort of putting himself into Proctor. Now, I think probably his point of view, his worldview is most reflected in Edward Avon, but he's putting himself the man into Proctor, I thought, in terms of, I could be totally wrong about this, this is just my speculation, but the family life that we see of Proctor's, which is, you know, for the most part, good. Like, he has this family, it's multi-generations. And the bits about Proctor's relationship with his kids felt like they were written by someone who had adult kids to me. Little details, like they have this big party for the twins' birthday. They have twins in college, and there's multi-generations of Proctors there, from the 87-year-old Uncle Ben, I think, who is actually closer to, in age to Le Carre than Proctor, you know, at the time that he wrote it. But I don't think Le Carre is relating to Uncle Ben. From 87-year-old Uncle Ben down to, you know, grandchildren or whatever. But the details of that, he seems to relate to Proctor, who must be in his 60s at the time, I'm guessing. He was in Argentina during the Falklands War, so he's got to be at least, yeah, he's got to be in his 60s, I think. And
he mentions Proctor's in his mid-50s,
I think. Oh, really? Well, like we discussed when we talked about, was it Agent Running in the Field or what? No, Agent Running in the Field. I'm not sure that the ages quite work out, like in that one, you know, because I think to be a station chief, because wasn't he the station chief in Argentina when the Falklands War broke out? And to be at that point, maybe he was just starting his career, but I think he was the station chief. That would have to put the character into his 60s, but yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, obviously Smiley's age, if you tried to figure that in Legacy of Spies, would be, you know, yeah, it doesn't quite
melt
work.
Your brain there.
But yes. I think that he's who, you know, and then he talks about, like, when the scent of marijuana comes along, the parents politely excuse themselves and go upstairs, and then it becomes the young person's party, you know. And then Proctor has this great bit that he shares with his wife, Helen, that he doesn't want to be seen. She wants him to get ready for bed, but he's expecting a call on his ultra secret phone, and he won't be seen by the young generation going down in a dressing gown, because that makes him feel really old. So he's staying dressed. And that to me felt like the detail of someone who had adult children, you know, who and had been in that kind of situation. So I think to a certain degree, Le Carre is putting his own life experiences into Proctor, although I don't believe his worldview is reflected by Proctor's.
No, yeah, that whole party scene that we see very early on in the book, and really does set up the character of Proctor and his dilemmas that we see kind of play out through the rest of the book, I do feel felt very real. Like it was drawn from life in a way that, if it wasn't something that, you know, he was really pulling from reality, he made it feel that way,
yeah,
which is, you know, great.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, not surprising. He is a great author who has created many great characters, but for those details felt lived in a particular way to me.
Yeah.
And I mentioned Proctor's wife, Helen. I do think this is a step back. We also, when we discussed Agent Running in the Field on a different podcast, we talked about it having some of his better female characters. And I think overall, he did become better in recent years, you know, with obviously a knock against him throughout his career has been his female characters. And there are some exceptions. There are some absolutely great ones, like Elsa Fannin, who you were discussing recently, or Connie Sachs in the Tinker Tailor series. But a lot of the female characters are objects of lust glimpsed through the man's eyes only, and don't really have agency themselves. Again, variations on the honorable schoolboy character, or sometimes just don't feel like lived in characters the way we were just discussing Proctor feeling it. He had been getting better with that, and I did feel that the older character's wife in the last book was a very fully realized character and one of his better female characters. Now we're back to the wives who are possibly cheating as their main character trait. You know, like there's two wives in this who may be betraying their spouses. And it's not that that's their only trait. They do have some others, but they are not fleshed out in the way that the male characters are in this book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think when we're talking about Helen, who's Proctor's wife, she's more of she's not a character in that she gives Proctor something to wrestle with that's outside of this whole spy story that we'll get to a little later. Right. I think I would say that Deborah, who is Teddy, Edward Avon's wife, felt a little different in that way. I would say she had a little different motivation that is more difficult to see early on in the book, but as we go on, becomes a lot clearer and I think a little easier on a second read to kind of see her trajectory. And we also have Lily, who is Edward and Deborah's daughter, who bounces right off the page, I would say, right off, because she's the first character that we really meet in this book is Lily, even though we don't really know who she is or why she's there. And she does kind of leap right out there as a interesting character in a way that,
yeah,
you know, you don't normally see in some of Le Carre's female characters.
Yeah, no, you're right. They're both interesting characters. And Deborah is certainly, she has her own motivations going on for sure. I still feel that she is only glimpsed through men's eyes in the book, and her function happens in the way that the three male characters view her, you know, Teddy and Julian and Proctor. But yes, you're right. She is a more, her motivations are very unique and feel real, but she's also put in a position where the ideals that she represents are clearly meant to be lesser than those that her husband represents, I think. So that puts her in, I mean, well, when we get to discussing the actual plot, we'll talk more about that, but that puts her in a narratively subservient position, I would say. But yes, she is certainly a memorable, she's a sort of doyen of the Secret Service who spent many years as the head of their Arab division. Is that what they call it? Do they call it Middle East or Arab?
Yeah, I think he kind of uses them all interchangeably.
Okay. Of their Middle East division, and had an illustrious service career. And then there's, and Lily, I really loved Lily. She's great, but there's just too little of her ultimately for her to register to me as a really substantial character, you know. And again, it's more how she's seen through the eyes of the man in the story, which again, we've said that the narrative unfolds through these two men, so of course all the characters are going to be seen through their eyes. But I think that is more the case with, you know, Edward is also seen through other people's eyes, but we've already discussed how he develops a very full personality despite that. And I'm not sure that any of the women get as full a personality as that, but I very much liked Lily. She's a good character. She is an enigmatic character though. So by design, we are deprived of her inner feelings throughout, you know, we have to guess at them. She values her privacy. She won't tell her parents if she's dating a man or a woman, you know, they're trying to guess. She won't reveal to anyone who the father of her baby is. And none of these things are revealed to us, the readers, either, since she keeps them from the characters who serve as our narrative guides.
Yeah, no, I think you're right in that she's an interesting character, but she's not fully there in the way that we see some of the other folks shown. So I would say if we're looking at our main characters, we've got Julian, the bookseller, who has recently moved to town, who is then kind of befriended by Edward, who is this older guy who is known his father. And then we learn that Proctor is over time kind of looking into Edward because he's got some sort of motivation for kind of digging into his past. And at the same time, Julian kind of getting to know both Lily and Deborah, who are Edward's family. Are there other characters that you feel like we should touch on here that are substantial enough to really kind of motivate a lot of the story?
Yes, there are certainly some other very memorable characters who we meet along the journey, particularly those being interviewed. And again, yeah, like I mentioned with some of its antecedents, like Honorable Schoolboy, some of the most memorable characters do only get a chapter. For me, in particular, there is a couple who had spied for the service for many years as a couple, and Proctor goes to them looking for information about Edward's past because they worked with him in the field, and that's Philip and Joan. I don't recall their last name. Do you remember that?
No, I don't even know if he gave it to
us. Yeah, we might not have gotten it, but they're very interesting. And then there's also a security officer on an Air Force base who's pretty interesting. But talking first about Philip and Joan, they're just really memorable. Like, they're we only spend one chapter with them, but they feel they're probably drawn from life in a lot of ways. You know, Le Carré certainly knew a lot of service retirees, you know, both people he had served with himself back in the 60s, but also I get the impression from the various biographies that he continued to meet people in that world, or that they would seek him out. And this is a couple who literally finishes each other's sentences or prompts each other, you know, how to in recalling something together as they're remembering their time spent during the Balkan crisis in the 90s. And Proctor remembers them as like as the golden couple of the Secret Service. And he seems taken aback by how aged they are since then. Although I don't get the impression that age has really slowed them down. They may not work for the service anymore, but they're still pretty indefatigable characters, even if the hallmarks that we get from them now are very much associated with aging and, you know, what we know from our parents and relatives who are getting older, and what I'm sure Le Carré knew intimately from getting to be that age himself. But they're still incredibly so Philip has suffered a fall recently and has a bruised eye when he goes to meet him, but you know, he jokes it off. You can really tell this sort of relationship that they have. Now, this is a fairly unusual thing in Le Carré, in that they really seem to be a genuinely strong couple. She's making all sorts of jokes about him having eyes for the nurses who are taking care of him and stuff, but these do not seem like jabs like Smiley would make at Anne, you know, or something. This seems to me to be a genuinely loving couple, which is also something we got in Agent Running in the Field with the main character. Did you have that reaction to them? Did you think that they were a actual solid marriage, or just professionals who had worked together? And
no, yeah, I think they definitely had they had been through hell and back kind of together, and had become so comfortable with each other and all of their, you know, faults and virtues. You definitely got that sense when Le Carré was describing the two of them together.
Yeah, and Joan, you know, she seems to have the better memory at this point, and she sort of guides Philip through his recollections, but she doesn't, you know, Proctor notes how she's careful to let him tell his story. She doesn't cut him off or anything. We've seen other couples in Le Carré where one or the other is constantly cutting off the other one, you know, and making the story their own. Joan never does that, and Philip doesn't do that with her because they each give their recollections, and that will lead them to have some comments, but they're never trying to hijack the thought process of the other one. You know, and there's also an idea that they're all, you know, this is the case, as many of the things in this book are reminiscent of other things in Le Carré. And in some ways it almost reads like a best of, you know, like, which may be part of the reason that he shelved it originally and didn't want to publish, because he might've felt that it seemed almost like Le Carré pastiche, even though it's by him. Yet that almost makes the perfect final novel, you know, in a way that it might not have made the perfect novel after A Delicate Truth, when he was still writing other stuff. But sorry, that's a bit of a tangent.
No, but it leads into something that I was thinking of as well, is that you really do have these kind of archetypal Le Carré characters that are here. You know, you've got the interrogator, you've got the kind of more naive person that's drawn into the machinery of the spy world, you've got this person, sometimes foreign, who is this passionate, you could say fanatical person driven against the machine of the British Secret Service, right? I mean, I think of our game, you know, Edward is very much like the character, one of the characters from our game, don't you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Who's got a passion that drives him for what is the name of that people in
caucus
in the caucuses, Urishi, something like that. I'm sorry, I didn't brush up on that one beforehand, but yeah, who a character who is really, you know, gone native, as they would have said in the colonial days, and really fallen in love with a people. And Edvard's passion for the people that he meets in the Balkans reminded me, yes, of that character very much. Also, the other character who's very much in line, I didn't refer to the book, I don't remember his name, but the defrocked priest in the sort of longest story in The Secret Pilgrim, who is a character I don't like. He's my least favorite Le Carre character, but that's for another time to discuss that book. But he's very much of that Westerby school of the people disillusioned with the secret world and finding their true passion with a people that they're living amongst. Your previous guest, B, was also talking a lot about Le Carre's Orientalist themes and, you know, this idea of the gone native person, which maybe that's how this ties into Conrad a little bit, but that's a very, you know, tenuous connection. This idea is certainly a recurring theme in his work. And I think it's absolutely meant to be an endearing one. You know, every time we meet the characters with that trait, this is the character he wants us to identify with in the book. And I think in this book, we are absolutely supposed to admire Edvard's convictions, even though he betrays his country. Well, his adopted country.
Yeah. Well, and when you look at some of the other characters, even the minor characters, you know, when we get to SIS headquarters, right, there's this very, very similar character that's in charge to just almost like, I can't count on one hand the number of times we've seen this kind of guy who falls to the top
right
there through no understanding of our narrator, and this kind of dragon lady-esque HR, or, you know, there's the HR
or legal, or
personnel person, yeah, or legal, always a woman that is just, you know, always trying to keep things in line. And our, you know, quote unquote hero character is just kind of disgusted by, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of these Le Carre archetypes turn up for sure. And again, you know, maybe he saw that in his lifetime that might be viewed as repeating himself, but it's like comfort food for me reading it after he's passed, after, you know, we were afraid that we might never get another Le Carre novel, to visit these archetypes who have populated so many of his novels. It just gives me, you know, a warm and fuzzy feeling. It's like, it's exactly what I want from this final novel. Well, final complete novel. We'll see. There may still be some that are what we thought it might have been, that are incomplete works that his son completes. Yeah, from his final complete novel, which is vocabulary that the publicity was sure to use too, which leads me possibly to that conclusion as well. But yeah, all the characters here feel like variations on others he has done, but that is not a negative to me. To me, that's a net positive with this book.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think he's, because the book is not long, I think the fact that he is using some of these characters, types that we've seen before, gives him the ability to do some of that shorthand and still make a shorter novel very effective.
What I will say negatively about that is that they don't feel fully fleshed out. You know, he may rely on that archetype crutch a little too much, and it works for me, you know, coming as a culmination of his career. I don't know if it requires that prior knowledge of his characters to work. I not coming to this fresh, you know, I can't say, you know, I'm not sure if someone who was reading this as their first Le Carre would react the same way. But I think that that, you know, I keep looking for what would he have done if he had kept revising it further, because I think a lot of his books were rewritten many, many times. You know, Seisman talks about all the rewriting that he would do, even in the page of facsimile manuscript that they include in the end of the special edition of this. You can see so many things crossed out just in that one manuscript page. So I'm sure he would have continued doing that. And I think one of the things that we might have got, you know, it definitely feels like a complete plot, but it feels so short compared to his other things. So what is it that would have maybe padded it out to the length of his normal novels had he done subsequent drafts? And I think that one of those things is character. I think the main thing that suffers from that is character. He creates some really good characters who are in line with part of proud lineages within his work. But I think had he actually done further rewrites that to the degree that he usually does, I think the book would have gotten thicker on character. And I think that all of these characters would have been more fleshed out than we meet them in this book. It's not, they work as they are, but had he actually completed this in the way that he normally completed things, I think we would, I think that we would know more about them. Do you agree? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I think we'd see a different book if he had gone back to this again, mm-hmm. But we're going to save a few more of those discussions about what our opinion on this book is as a whole for a future episode. But for this one, I think that covers the main characters that we wanted to talk about. That's going to be it for this episode. I'll have links to some of the things we talked about today in the show notes and on the episode page at lecarrecast.com. If you enjoyed the show, you'd be doing a huge favor by subscribing and reviewing it on Apple Podcasts or whatever place you listen to. Podcast on. It will help other Le Carre fans find the show. And you can always drop me a comment on the website or on Twitter at Le Carre Cast. You can follow me as I talk about non-Le Carre stuff at SpyWrite.com or SpyWrite on Twitter. We will be back next week to continue our look at Silverview by talking about the book's various settings and some of the places that we see. Until next time, thanks for listening. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.